Welcome to Your Turn. This is Mike Causey. Glad to have you with us. We're here every Wednesday at 10 a.m., and we like it when you're with us. So thank you for being here. Interesting guest today, a repeat guest, John Grobe, and he is a specialist in, I guess, getting a job, keeping a job, surviving on the job. And John wrote a guest column, which appeared today in the Federal Report in MySpace. And, John, what's the subject?
Subject is how the furlough has affected contractors. We've read a lot about how it has affected federal employees, but there certainly is a trickle-down effect on contractors.
Well, that's right. We've seen in a place like the Washington area, which is a tremendous number of federal contractors, the Brookings Institution some years ago estimated that for every one federal job, there are six contractors who work for the government. This is particularly true in places like NASA, Department of Energy. Even the CIA has a lot of contract workers, so it's very important. And when federal workers are furloughed, presumably contractors are furloughed too. They can't come in the building. They can't work alongside their federal counterparts. Have you got any numbers, John, any guess estimates as to how many private sector contractors have been furloughed because of the federal furlough and the sequestration?
I don't have any broad government-wide numbers, but I have talked to several contractors. One of them, a small business in the Silver Spring area, Synergy Enterprises, has had to lay off 10 people and cut the hours of others. Now, they're a special case in that in addition to their doing regular grant reviews and so on for different agencies, a lot of the work they do is associated with meeting planning. So they're getting a double whammy, what with the cutback in meetings due to the lavish GSA meetings and the backlash against that. Now, I've also talked to a larger business, FPMI Solutions, that has offices in both Alexandria and down in Madison, Alabama. And though they have not had to lay anyone off yet, they have had to cut hours back for subcontractors. A lot of contracting firms do not have employees, but they have independent contractors they use as subcontractors, and those people are having hours cut back and so on.
Yeah, the ripple effect of this is of course, something we don't know the full impact yet, but we know it's out there. And if you have somebody who plans meetings for the government and they have to lay off people, then that means the hotel or motel where they rent rooms to have these meetings, that's not going to happen. And then the caterers are not going to be called in to do this. So it is a double whammy on top of the GSA excesses and the backlash to that and the fact that we are into the sequestration. It could get a whole lot worse before it gets better.
I think it could. I think in the beginning, we're going to see contractors taking it a little harder than federal employees. And I think that service contracts are likely to see a more immediate hit than a hardware-type contract would.
Well, I talked to a private sector contractor in California, and his firm works for the U.S. Air Force, and he said that they had already started furloughs in anticipation of the DOD furloughs. And as you know, defense originally started out, they were going to furlough everybody for 22 days. And then, I guess, cooler heads prevailed. They got an infusion of money from Congress. They did some rejiggering, and then they dropped it down to, I believe, 12 days, and they're now looking at 7. Now, some people think this is a normal backlash from the original threat to furlough people, that it was largely political and they were trying to scare the Congress. Others say this is just simply good work by defense and they've managed to tighten their belt and minimize the number of furloughs. But the problem, of course, as you say, is that the private contractors don't have that sort of leeway, and they need the money coming in immediately. So if a federal worker is furloughed for one day, it's possible that several contractors could be furloughed for a couple of days.
It could be. And there's a federal law, the WARN Act, which stands for Worker Adjustment Retraining Notification, that comes into play when you have a larger contractor. A contractor with above a certain number of employees is required by law to give a 60-day advance notice of layoffs. That could be an issue when contractors don't know when the government or how much the government is going to be furloughing and how much the government is going to be either canceling or cutting back contracts. In the early stages of the sequester, there were two or three situations where contractors ran into violations of the Warren Act. And in fact, the Department of Labor encouraged them to ignore the Warren Act. I think that just throws a little, another little wrench into the works and provides more work for labor attorneys.
Well, I remember when that happened, and a lot of people were shocked and astounded by it because this was before the election. And the Department of Labor sent out notices to these various groups and contractors and said, look, we know you're required by law to give either a 60 or a 30-day notice, depending on the situation and the state and that sort of thing. But they said, don't send them out. Don't worry about it. It's not going to happen, and you don't want to worry people. And they said, if in fact you get into trouble later on by violating this law, violating this act, we will pay for it. We'll pick up the slack. Now, a lot of people were very suspicious that that was a political move to not scare the contracting community and the federal community before the election. Then shortly after the election, when the results were in, the Labor Department switched its tune and told people they needed to comply with this law.
Yeah, I would agree with your assessment that it may very well have been a political move. And, you know, when Congress starts poking their noses in there, we start getting odd results. For example, the military has pushed, or I should say DOD, has pushed for another round of BRAC closings, and Congress has denied it. And another situation similar, although certainly not dealing with contractors, is how Congress is dealing with the United States Postal Service. The Postal Service has sought many different ways of reducing their expenses, such as going to five-day delivery, closing post offices, and so on. Yet, very often, the congressman who is screaming at the post office to reduce their expenses is going to have a real issue when his constituents or her constituents write to him or her and complain about closing the post office in Wolf's Ear.
That's been around forever, since the days of Benjamin Franklin almost. But whenever the post office department, now the U.S. Postal Service, whenever they run into trouble, they talk about eliminating post offices, which people don't like because they like having their own, postmark for their letters. They like having a post office, particularly in a rural area, as a meeting place where they can go, they can meet their friends and pick up their mail or just drop things off or pick up gossip. And the idea of eliminating Saturday delivery horrifies some people, too. And the Postal Service knows this. It's sort of like baiting a bear.
Mm-hmm. You're absolutely right there. There was an article in a recent Federal Times about how large contractors are being affected by the sequester. It was in the April 15th edition, and an Army spokesperson came right out and said they will have to delay contracts. In fact, an Army training contract, an $8 billion contract, is being delayed by 9 months. So delays can also have an adverse effect on the individuals who work for contractors or who are subcontractors with them.
Yeah, and I think we don't have any idea of how far-reaching this is yet, because when people think of the federal government, they tend to think of Washington, D.C., Maryland, and Virginia suburbs. But that's only 14% of the federal population. The vast majority of federal workers are elsewhere. They're in California, they're in Texas, they're in Florida, they're in places you wouldn't think. I recently got a passport update, and it came from the State Department in New Hampshire. They have an office up there, and the government is everywhere, and it's all over, and that means the government contractors are everywhere and all over. Listen, we need to take a short break here. I'm speaking with John Grobe, and he's a specialist in getting a job, keeping a job, and today we're talking about the ripple effect of the furloughs on federal contractors. Take a short break here on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to Your Turn, Mike Causey. Delighted to have you with us. Remember, we're here every Wednesday at 10 a.m., and our shows are archived on our homepage, so you can listen anytime, and we have had some extremely good shows in the past that you might want to check out. Our goal here is to sort of follow the money. We don't get into policy and wonkiness very much. We're really following the money, and today we're doing that, talking with John Grove. He's an expert in getting a job, keeping a job, and today's subject, and he wrote a guest column for me that appears in today's Federal Report, is about the impact of furloughs on federal contractors. For those of you who don't know or don't think about it, there are something like 6 federal contractors for every single federal employee. And in some federal agencies, contractors outnumber feds dramatically, and others not so much. But there are a lot of contractors with NASA. There are a lot of contractors with the Department of Energy. Even the CIA across the river from us here has a large number of contractors. Defense probably has the largest number of all. And John Grove is here today as our expert witness. John, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I am one of those contractors to start out with. I had a federal career of 26 years, primarily with the Postal Service and the Internal Revenue Service. And while there, I worked in many different human resource type areas, benefits, so I know quite a bit about federal retirement, career development, and career transition. I worked with a so-called voluntary outplacement program with one of the agencies. And since I retired, my own business, Federal Career Experts, deals primarily with providing training for agencies in the areas of retirement, career transition, and career development. In fact, I have a recent book, Career Transition, A Guide for Federal Employees, that is available from FPMI. Their website is fpmipublications.com.
Very good. Okay, so you've been there, done that, and been on both sides of it. Now, we're talking about the impact of the federal furloughs, which have just begun this month, in the month of April, actually, it started, and the impact on government contractors. And in the first segment of our show, you mentioned that you had some anecdotal information about contractors and that you had talked to some who have already either furloughed people or actually laid people off, which is even worse.
Yes, indeed. I'll start with my own company, which is small. And with that, we have had half of our already scheduled business canceled, business that was already booked and was actually paid for out of 2012 money. So we've had that pulled back. That's what got me thinking about the effect of the sequester on contractors, because it happened to be affecting me. I checked with another small business and a larger business and found that both of them are being hit by the sequester. One, Synergy Enterprises out in Silver Spring, has had to lay off 10 people. And another, FPMI Solutions, both in Alexandria and down in the Huntsville, Alabama area, has had to cut back hours. The I talked to the president of Synergy Enterprises and the executive VP of FPMI Solutions, and one thing they both see coming, they don't see this as being short-term necessarily, they both see downward pressure on pricing as more contractors are just struggling to keep their people employed.
Well, Senator Harry Reid, the Senate Majority Leader, last week introduced a bill that would, in effect, eliminate the sequester, that it would, or put a moratorium on it. And he was then urging the Democrats and the Republicans to get back together and talk about other ways to do this. The hang-up, of course, is that the congressional Democrats and the White House want to raise taxes, particularly on the very wealthy, but they do want tax increases in a number of areas. The Republicans don't want any tax increase, but they want entitlement cuts, and these sort of go to the heart of their various constituencies. What's your sense out there in the Midwest about how Washington is doing?
Oh, gee, the first word that popped into my mind, Mike, was a sense of hopelessness. Mm-hmm. The sense that these people have not agreed in the past when there is the room for compromise, and the fact that they said, oh, the sequester will not happen because it is too terrible, yet they went ahead and let it happen. I mean, I think we might want to see a return of people who could actually talk to each other in positions of power as opposed to people who are talking at each other.
You know, you hear that from so many, if I will, old-timers, and I include myself in that, but they talk about the lack of civility in the Congress today between Republicans and Democrats in the House and the Senate. And in the old days, which were not that long ago, these people socialized together. Their kids played Little League baseball together, oftentimes went to the same schools. And now with what we call the TWT Club, the Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday Club, many members of Congress are away from Washington more than they're here. Many of them don't live here. I believe there are 30 members now who literally live in their offices. They're literally their home is their office, and then they go home on those very long weekends. So they don't know each other. You can sense it in watching hearings and seeing the debates that many of them literally don't like each other. And is there any hope?
Well, of course, we can look at this as a pendulum where it's perhaps as bad as it will get now, and it will slowly get better. You think of the days, me being an old-timer, too,
yeah.
You go back to President Reagan and Tip O'Neill. They certainly didn't agree on much, but they did know how to get things done. And even further, to show how much of an old-timer I am, LBJ and Everett Dirksen from Illinois. They were still able to work with each other and find areas they could agree on, just engage in negotiation. I think one issue with Congress people straying from the party line is, let's just say I am a Democrat who might be willing to cut entitlements in exchange for revenue increases, and I'm up for election next year. Well, I can pretty much count on a challenge from the left. Look at a Republican who might be willing to look at some tax increases in exchange for entitlement cuts, and I bet you a dollar to a dime they will get a challenge from the right.
Yeah, I don't think we've seen the strength of the extremes in either party the way we have now. And it's interesting you'd mention President Johnson and I guess it was Senate Minority Leader Everett Dirksen of Illinois, a Republican. I've heard some of the White House tapes courtesy of CNN, and in a number of them, Johnson will be talking to somebody. In one case, he was talking to Senator Dirksen, and they got their business out of the way. And then he said, I think Dirksen said, is Lady Bird around? And Johnson said, yes, she's standing right here. And he said, would you put her on Joanne or whatever his wife's name wanted to talk to him? And these two women, the wife of the president and the wife of the minority leader, had a nice long chat about the recent visit they'd had. They made plans for dinner or something like that. And you hear this again and again in these old tapes between presidents. Tip O'Neill and Ronald Reagan, famous case, you know, two Irishmen telling jokes and backslapping and having a good old time, although they were polar opposites politically. And we don't seem to have that now. And we certainly need it. But I don't. If anybody has the formula, please send it to us here at Federal News Radio.
Yeah, I think we have another challenge coming up the next time we reach the debt limit, which I believe is going to be later this month.
That's right.
Where we'll see if there's any attempt at compromise or reaching some kind of mutual agreement.
Well, I think you're right, too. Earlier when you said this sequester, nobody thought it would happen. I would have bet a fairly large sum of money that it wouldn't happen. President Obama, even though they drafted it, said it was too awful to happen, and he famously said in a couple of speeches and news conferences, he said, it's not going to happen. And, of course, it did happen, and everybody's surprised and horrified by it and seems to want to get out of it now. But John, listen, I really appreciate you taking time out to be with us this morning, and we'll get back to you and give the address where people can get your book.
Yeah, they can order Career Transition, a guide for federal employees from FPMI at www.fpmipublications.com.
All right. Thank you, John Grobe. Thank you all for listening. Stay tuned. We're going to be talking with the guys from the Federal Times about various issues pending, and we will see you later here on Federal News Radio. Thank you. Hey, welcome back to Your Turn. This is Mike Causey. We have Sean Riley and Stephen Losey from the Federal Times are here. Sean, are you with us?
Steve? Steve Losey is here.
Steve, okay, excellent. Yeah, we got staticked out. Steve, OPM has said that it's going to cut back on overtime payments to those people who have been working to cut down the backlog of retirement applications and processing them. What is that all about?
Well, this is a yet another consequence of that wonderful sequester policy everyone loves so much. OPM is doing their best to try to avoid having to furlough employees to meet the sequester budget cuts. So one of the steps they're taking is suspending overtime for employees working on processing the pensions. Now, this is something that's been a long-standing problem at OPM. We're talking for decades here. Nobody's quite been able to get their arms around it. And the problem is that for many federal retirees, they have to wait months and months and months for their full pension. Now, last year, OPM unveiled a OPM's John Berry unveiled a wide-ranging plan to try to fix this problem once and for all. It included hiring a lot of new people to process these pension claims, and it included throwing overtime at the problem and making sure that only people who really have really shown they can get the job done get this overtime. And you know what? It had a real effect. Since last January, OPM has cut the backlog of unprocessed claims by 40%. So it was making progress, but now that OPM is being forced to suspend overtime, who knows what's going to happen? OPM is cautioning retirees, hey, this is going to inevitably lengthen the process. It's going to mean it takes longer for us to process your pension claims. So fair warning. So this is going to, we don't know exactly how it's going to complicate matters, how much it's going to complicate matters, that is, how much it's going to delay things, but it is inevitably going to throw a wrench in OPM's efforts to fix this long-standing problem.
Right, and bottom line is, if you're planning to retire anytime in the near or maybe even in the far future, you better have some savings and something to live on, or else you're going to be tapping your TSP before you wanted to.
That's right. That's still a probably good advice.
Hey, you, Sean, you talked about a drop in the combined federal campaign pledges. Is this another one?
Third in a row, and fairly pretty much more significant than the last two. I mean, total pledges were down about 6%, and this is the 2012 campaign, you know, down to about, about $257 million overall. So that was the, you know, as I said, down about 6%. It's, you know, at least the lowest number since 2004. And, you know, the concern is that this doesn't seem to be turning around, you know, off OPM, which oversees the CFC, you know, has proposed a pretty sweeping overhaul that's now out for public comment. It was published in the Federal Register early last month. But it's not clear that, you know, they're going to be what they're proposing in the, you know, in the view of some CFC participants and organizers is going to be sufficient to, you know, to turn this around.
Right. Well, obviously, we've had 3 years of pay freezes. The health insurance premiums have gone up and people are cutting back in a variety of ways. One of this thing could have long-range significance, because even if everything came clear and rosy tomorrow, giving to charity is kind of a habit. And once people get out of that habit, it took years to get to federal workers to have one of the highest participation rates of any group in the country.
Right. I mean, this is the CFC, of course, bills itself as, you know, I think the world's largest workplace giving drive or charity drive. And, you know, particularly as you've got, to piggyback on what Steve was saying about retirements, I mean, as you have a lot of people leaving the workforce for whom giving was, you know, was a habit, who regularly participated in the CFC. I mean, postal workers have been a mainstay, and, of course, they've been leaving in droves. You know, the question is, who who's going to replace them, particularly when you have all these, you know, other giving options. I mean, you can contribute money by phone, you know, by your smartphone. And you know, also that, you know, the CFC involves a fairly significant investment of federal, you know, manpower, people, you know, loaned executives participating in the campaign, you know, in local campaigns. And the question is, who's going to replace those and who's going to, you know, kind of build those, build that giving habit among new entrants into the workforce?
Yeah, that's going to be a rebuilding process. It's going to hurt a lot of the smaller charities, most and first. Question on health insurance for both of you. The Republicans have introduced a plan in the House that would it looks like it would target the federal employee health benefits program, and but the Postal Service just the other day unveiled its plan. You know, we were all wondering when that shoe would drop, and apparently it has. What's going on with health insurance?
Well, the House, there's a bill introduced in the House that would basically kick federal employees off of FEHBP and onto the Obamacare exchanges. However, I don't really anticipate this going very far. It's there's nothing really wrong with FEHBP that that would require them to go on to these state exchanges for Obamacare. It seems to me to be a bit of a political bill, to be honest. The argument is, well, if Obamacare is so great, why not put federal employees onto it? Which, you know, the whole point of the Obamacare exchanges is to provide health care for people who don't have access to health care, and federal employees have access to health care.
That's right, the 15% that don't,
Even if the House were to pass it, it would die in the Senate, so I would not worry too much. If I was a federal employee, I would not worry too much about that bill.
Yeah, no member of Congress who spent any time on the Hill, and certainly congressional staffers, nobody wants to leave the federal employee health benefits program.
Yeah, that's right.
Now, how about the postal plan?
Well, the you know, the Postal Service, they just actually coincidentally announced, I think yesterday, that they've awarded a contract to United Healthcare to provide, and this is because of Obamacare, to provide coverage to up to 35,000 non-career postal employees. This is a first, I'm told. You know, they haven't had coverage through the Postal Service in the past. In regard to their you know, their other the career workforce, the Postal Service is still pushing a plan that would, you know, essentially, and they've apparently done some work with consultants. That would, you know, create their own health plan for about 1.1 million active employees and retirees, you know, with the overall goal of significantly driving down their health care costs. And they claim, heard the Postmaster General speak on this a week or so ago, that they can provide coverage, better coverage, at a more affordable price. And particularly they would, you know, this particularly affect retirees, because the idea would be that their first, you know, they would get their coverage first from Medicare, and secondly, from who, you know, whatever the backup plan that the Postal Service chooses to create. But I think, just like with the House bill that Steve was mentioning, there's this, you know, this proposal still, you know, has a very tough slog on Capitol Hill, and it has yet to get any significant, any, you know, demonstrable support from the administration, which it would really need to have.
Well, it's really hard to find anybody outside of the Postal Service upper echelon that sees how they can save money on this. The Postal Service is an industrial type operation. It's got people working assembly lines. It's got people out on the road 6 to 8 hours a day, you know, fairly dangerous jobs. And it has a fairly high accident rate. I would think it would they would want to stay within the FEHBP and be part of a safer pool, if you will.
Well, a lot of this is driven not so much by the cost of the active workforce, but by the retiree health care issues. And as you know, the Postal Service is currently, at least on paper, required to contribute about $5.5 billion each year to pre-fund benefits for future retirees. They're very eager to get out from that obligation, even though they haven't had the money to pay it in the last 2 years. And this would be this, you know, and creating their own standalone health plan would be one way of doing that. But again, it would require congressional approval, and so far there doesn't seem to be a huge amount of interest on Capitol Hill to do that.
Right, and neither of you thinks that the House bill to take feds out of the FEHBP or this initial postal plan has much of a chance, huh?
Well, the postal I'll let Steve speak to the House bill, but the postal plan, again, it hasn't really been introduced. It's not part of any standalone legislation. The most significant step, I think, thus far was in a contract that was decided by an arbitration panel a few months ago between the National Association of Letter Carriers and the Postal Service. Part of that agreement was creation of a task force to look at this issue. So that might provide some tangible progress going forward, at least from the Postal Service perspective. But this is something they've got to get agreement from their unions on, essentially. And so far, they're fairly, as far as I can tell, they're fairly wary of doing anything that would pull their members out of the FEHBP.
Very good. Well, Jen, thanks for being with us, as always. Thanks, Lauren Larson, for running the show. And again, we apologize for that static beforehand, but we got the gremlins out. We'll be here next week at 10 a.m. Remember, we're archived on our homepage, so you can listen to this show or any other at any time. We'll see you next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Have a good week.
Thanks, Mike.